Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 5th of October, Anno Domini 2013, and you lucky people. You're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
And I'm Dennis Worster.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Sadly, the hangout seems to have stopped, but we'll move on.
It's hung.
It seems too hung.
That's all right. We'll figure it out.
I don't know what it is.
All right. What's that first news story you've got, Nick?
Well, here it is. Researchers by UK telecoms regulator Ofcom have found that tablet usage among children is on the rise, with growing numbers of younger kids especially turning to tablets to watch videos, play games, and access the internet. The annual report into children's media consumption habits also records a drop in the overall number of children between the ages and 5 of 15 who own a mobile phone, with the percentage falling from 49% last year to 43% in 2013. It's the first such drop since the survey began in 2005. Ofcom says this decline is mainly down to a steep fall in the proportion of younger kids, 8 to 11, owning a basic mobile phone as opposed to a smartphone. Basic phone ownership among the latter age group stood at 28% last year and has fallen to steeply to 15%. Bottom line, you can't even flog feature phones to tweens. Now, that's not saying they don't have phones.
Right.
They don't have feature phones. They have smartphones.
Right. They have smartphones that can run apps and play videos and do other things. But apparently the tablets are much more popular among the younger kids.
Well, while basic phones are being ditched by kids, tablet usage is rising across the board. Among the younger kids age group, 18% own a smartphone and the same percentage own a tablet. However, the report notes that while the smartphone figure is largely stable year on year, tablet ownership has grown fourfold since last year when it stood at just 4%. As you might expect, smartphone ownership is higher among older children, 12 to 15, than 8 to 11s, with the older group being likely to be more interested in using connected devices to communicate rather than primarily looking for a gadget to watch audiovisual content and play games, likely why tablets well-suited to entertainment use case are doing so well with the younger kids category. But even among the older group, the report found that tablet usage was on the rise. The majority, 62%, of 12 to 15-year-olds own a smartphone, according to the research, a proportion that Ofcom has said is unchanged from last year, versus just over a quarter, 26%, who own a tablet computer. The latter figure is up considerably on last year when just 7% said they had a slate. So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, when should a child get a tablet? And your choices are, as soon as their little eyes can focus, when the peer pressure gets too much for their little psyches, when the crying and screaming finally get to me, and only when they can buy it themselves. So, we have about 29 votes. Not shockingly for this audience, the vast majority of you, 76% of you, think it's only when they can buy it themselves. I believe that's a healthy attitude. Now, I know
you say that. They say that now. Yeah. But when the time comes, they'll actually do it. I've seen toddlers with those. So, you know, they can say that all they want now, but, you know, later it's all going to change.
Right. And look at the proliferation of pre-kindergarten apps that are out there.
Oh, for sure. Everything from identifying colors and shapes to clicking on the button for the cow and hearing it say moo. I mean, it's a lot of the special Fisher-Price stuff that we might have had as kids.
Yep.
Where you pull the string and then it plays the really scratchy recording. The cow says,
yeah, right.
And it was sort of sounded like a cow. But now, you know, you've got full fidelity and nonstop stereo sound and colorful animation. It's kind of the evolution of those devices. But, you know, they just run on batteries now instead of pulling a string.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, you'll have more to say about this. I know you will. So if you check down the right-hand column, you will see a section labeled Fascinating Stuff. You can go to the forums there and look for the October 5th, 5 October 13, when should a child get a tablet? And, of course, you can give us a call. The number is 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415. My daughter did not get a tablet. And I'm not saying a smartphone. She had a smartphone in high school.
Okay.
She had one of my cast-offs, as a matter of fact. That's how that worked.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Well, we felt at that age she needed to at least be able to call home.
Right.
You know, and so there was a phone sitting there, and it just happened to be a smartphone.
Okay.
Right. I mean, it had been a feature phone, she would have gotten that.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
But we just needed to be able to call home. But she got a tablet, actually, not until college.
Okay.
When she was looking at, you know, 30, 40 pounds of books.
Right.
To carry around. And I said, you know, if they're available as e-books, I'll get you Nexus 7.
Right.
For a couple of $100. And then you've got the Kindle app and the Nook app and the Google app. And between the three of them, we found 99% of her books.
I see. Okay.
And so instead of carrying around, you know, and having to run back to her locker and doing all that stuff, she's got the tablet to do all the reading. Plus, it does all the other stuff, too.
Right, right. I wonder, is that becoming more common in before college, when you
yes.
go to high school
yes.
or junior high?
Yeah. Yes. At the last, my senior year in high school, a lot of kids were doing that in classes where the teachers would allow it. In college, it's practically everywhere. That's how you can, in college, that's how you can split the haves and the have-nots up. The haves...
Yep.
All have tablets with all their textbooks and apps and extensions on them. And then the have-nots like me, the poor people, have books.
Yeah, but, right. And that's why it's nice that prices are coming down
right.
on the tablets where you can get.
And they really are.
Yeah, they really are.
They really are coming down. I mean, you're seeing tablets in the $200 range and sometimes less. It's amazing to think that 4 or 5 years ago, you needed to spend at a minimum $500
yep.
to get really into that.
I tell my students, first day of class, I cannot log in. It's not letting me sign in. I tell my students the first day of class, everybody look down. If you're seeing something with which to take notes, you have a chance to pass this class.
Absolutely.
If you are looking at simulated wood grain veneer, you likely will flunk.
Right. Yeah. If your desk is empty in front of you.
You're done.
Yeah.
You're done. It's, and I've had kids actually come up and say, I'm taking notes on my phone. Is that okay? Yes, that's fine with me.
If it works for you, yeah. Right.
Oh, and it looks like I'm back in the video.
It comes down to what tool do you feel most comfortable with. And as much as my wife hates it when I do this, I will often grab a sheet of paper and a pen to scribble things out just to get things out of my head or to diagram something or do something else, because the digital tools, when you put a mouse in your hand, suddenly you've got all these other options
yep.
where it's like, well, do I want to take notes in this font or in this font? And I'm like, no, I'm just going to go with the one handwriting font that I know that my hand can do, and we'll stick with that. And sometimes narrowing yourself down to that simplicity really can
it focuses aid, you.
It focuses you, and it aids your productivity considerably.
Yeah, absolutely. It looks like the Hangout is back.
All right.
I don't know if I'm the one who's back or if everybody's back. I don't know if it's being recorded. I think it is.
Okay.
We just don't know.
If you're in the Hangout, give us a call.
Yeah, let us know. Smiley's there.
Oh, my goodness.
Dee is there. I don't know.
All right.
If it's being recorded, I can't
And if my wife and kids are listening, Kelly and Katrina and Jillian and Doug and Eric, hop on the Hangout and come and join us there.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's a different. It's becoming a different world. One of the problems is that a lot of I know this because I'm on the other side too as a teacher.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the textbook publishers are not interested in ebooks because they worry about theft.
Right.
Well, when a textbook is $140,
you got your money up front.
Yeah. when it's a book,
photocopy it right. all you want.
Right. But if it's a book, but if it's an ebook. One person pays the $140, breaks the encryption, sells it to everybody else for $20, makes back their money, easily. but the company doesn't. Right. And that's, I get that. I do get that. But they need to deal with that in some way because the old model just isn't working anymore.
Right. Yeah, there needs to be some type of rental arrangement, or there needs to be something that works well for everybody.
And, now, there is a
they're just very, very scared about losing that control because for so long, if you owned the printing press, you owned the means of getting the information to the people. So you could charge pretty much whatever you want. College textbooks, man, what a racket. It's never been more expensive to buy a book than when you first step onto a college campus.
Yep.
And right. when I went to school, and way back in the 90s, the concept of buying a textbook online and not paying the manufacturer's suggested retail price was an amazing concept, and it really had even the college bookstores scared to think that you could do that. Now there's all sorts of ways to do that with used textbooks and third party companies that will do that, and boy. It's really interesting to see where this is going.
Right. Well, you can buy used stuff at half.ebay.com.
Right.
You know, and there's a company out there that's essentially doing a lending library of books, and I thought it was oyster.com, but it doesn't appear to be.
Well, and then if you think about it, you've got stuff like MIT OpenCourseWare, where they literally hand out. It's just as if you're sitting in the audience of the lecture.
Right.
And they're using that to tout their great teachers and the great courses that they have. And you sort of wonder if even going to college is something that might become kind of archaic in the next generation or two.
Well, that's an interesting thing. All the MOOCs that are out there, MOOC, massively open online courses.
Right.
The MOOCs.
Yeah, but the problem with online courses, because I have there's a couple of people in my class that do other courses at Brockport Online, and the first thing they tell me is the big problem with online courses is it lacks the interactiveness. You can't see the person face to face.
That's true. The
personal touch,
right?
And that's the problem with online courses.
Well, the big problem with online courses is that we don't know how to do them yet. There's got to be a way to do that and give the personal touch. I don't know what it is. I mean, you can do things like Google Hangouts, assuming they freaking work.
Come on, you guys. figure this out. You know, you'd think it wouldn't be so hard.
Yeah, again,
I
don't...
Every other week. Sometimes I'll tune in. You can go to hangouts.google.com and get involved and see us and our lovely faces. Some of us have faces for radio. Like me. and hang out with us there.
Yep.
So we're working on getting that back up and running. But courses in general, boy, you're right. It's a trade-off between having interaction, having things be well recorded, which is important, making sure that you can actually hear what everybody's saying, and also getting that feedback capability of when you have a question, how do you get it answered? And if you're sitting in the class, you just raise your hand and you get an immediate response.
It's like, sure, you can stay at home and do it, but you're losing a lot doing that. And that's right. The problem, and that's why you don't see a lot of people my age doing online classes.
Right.
It's because it doesn't have that personal touch.
Right. Well,
for adults, it's different because they got work, they got other things they're doing. We don't necessarily have that,
right?
So it's easier for us to go. And when we have the choice of going on campus and doing and having the personal touch, learning face to face, being interactive, and as opposed to doing the entire thing online and not having that experience, we're going to choose the first one.
Right. And there are really two models that are being looked at right now in general. One is the we're not coming into the classroom, but it's basically a classroom experience. You use something like Adobe Connect. Mm-hmm. Everybody logs in.
Right.
The teacher talks. You ask questions by typing, blah, blah, blah. That's okay, but it's essentially just it's classroom with the techno gimmick. Right.
Right. Much like taking notes on your tablet or on your phone.
Right. The other way to do it is to make it asynchronous, which is the goal, of course, so you can get a whole lot more students in.
Sure.
But by making it asynchronous, what that means is I record a lecture, which you then view. Then I have to have office hours where you can get on and talk to me.
Yeah.
But when do I hold the office hours? How do I make it? I once taught an online course. This is true. I figured out I had one human being in every time zone that touched land.
I see.
How do you do anything that makes the people in China and Montana equally happy?
Right, right. Well, that's when it's a little too distributed.
Well, but and then that comes down to we should as not me, but the people who are doing the putting the classes together and enrolling students in classes, they should be grouping them by
hemisphere.
Well, at least by hemisphere.
Right.
You know, within a few time zones of each other.
Sure. That's an interesting approach. I think that makes more sense than anything I can come up
with. If they want to hire me to teach a class at 3 in the morning to people in Asia,
right,
I will happily do that, but make sure all the people are in Asia and all the people are working at 3 in the morning.
And make sure you're paying me more, too, because if I'm going to get up at 3 in the morning to do that.
yes.
Differential compensation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a given, but it's also a possibility. Should we take a break before we do this?
Yeah, that'd probably be a good idea.
Yeah, all right. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dennis Worster, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 20 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. If you're on the line, stay on the line. If you're not on the line, why not? Give us a call. It's Soundbites right here on the truly great and truly member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dennis Worster.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 25 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Bodan from Rochester, New York on the line. Hiya, Bodan. What's up?
Hi, guys. Good afternoon to you. Got a question. I wanted to see what you guys would do in this situation. Let's say you're hypothetically going away for a long weekend where you're not going to be home for 3 or 4 days. Do you power down all of your computer hardware, meaning the monitor, the computer itself, everything else, including the modem, or do you maybe just turn it off and still keep the power strip on so there is some phantom power going to the hardware, or do you kill the power strip and just eliminate any power going to the equipment?
This has been
a great question.
Well, this has been the age-old question that everybody who's done computer support has gotten for ever, as long as there have been personal computers in people's household. Do I leave it on? Do I just shut it off? Do I shut everything off with the power strip?
You're right. He's gotten that wrinkle in of, do you just leave the power strip on? Therefore, there's a trickle available, so you're not using the internal battery on the motherboard.
Yeah, okay. Well, the internal battery is like a watch battery, and I tend to think that's going to last for years and years. It's not going to be charged by leaving it plugged in.
But it's not also going to be drained if there's a trickle charge coming in.
Yeah, basically it boils down as this. If I'm going away for 3 or 4 days, everything is plugged into one power strip surge protector. Do I turn everything off completely where there's no power going to, the PC, the monitor, the router, stuff like that?
Well, let's think about it this way. And not to answer a question with a question, but I kind of have to. What do you want to protect yourself against?
Is there any need to consume electricity? That's the bottom line.
If you don't want to consume electricity, unplug the stuff.
There is no need to, no.
But on the other hand, am I going to damage anything by giving the system a electrical shock, if you want to use that phrase, when I turn everything back on and turn the power strip on and then...
Well, you're going to do that anyway.
No, the capacitors will know how to take that.
Yeah, you're going to do that anyway, and it's only when machines, when those capacitors are weakened that you have that problem of the electric shock. Here's the deal. The only thing that really becomes different... there are really two things. First, you're gonna be using the tiny bit more of that 5-year battery.
Yeah, very, very tiny.
But very tiny amount of that 5-year battery. The second thing is the thing that you might want to worry about a little more will be the temperature difference. If you leave your machines on all the time, they're running at a fairly constant temperature. And now you're going to cool them down, and then you're going to warm them back up again. But you know what? The components are designed to do that.
Right. Today's modern equipment, I'm not too worried about
this. If you were to unplug your laptop and then leave it in your garage in February, I might say don't do that. But just leaving it in your house,
Room temperature?
At room temperature, it doesn't matter. And it's your choice whether that you want to leave that trickle charge on or not. I tend to leave it on mainly because I generally forget to turn it off.
Mm-hmm. I generally will leave them on. The only time I turn them off is if I know I'm going out of town and I don't know what the weather's going to be, and perhaps there's going to be a big storm and a lightning strike nearby. If my stuff is literally unplugged from the wall, there I have no worries about it receiving any type of overvoltage.
And, of course, unplugged from your land.
Yes.
And I also remember a gentleman mentioning one thing about cable modems, like for a Roadrunner. By the way, I was able to find a model, one of the Motorola's online for $30.
Nice.
Awesome. So now you're not paying that, what, $5.95 or $4.95 a month?
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, I remember one of you guys mentioning something that if, when you turn off that modem and you turn it back on, it's searching for the addresses and stuff like that.
That's true.
What was that about, Nick?
Well, basically, they work like this. When you turn a modem, when you turn any device on that connects to the internet, in general, there are two ways to do it. And the way that it works for Time Warner and most and Frontier and most companies is they come back on and they say, hey, I'm on the network. But I don't have an address. Give me one. And then the address server, the DHCP server, will say, oh, welcome. Here's your address. But what that means is every time you turn it off, you and it comes back up, you may get a different address.
Right.
You don't care.
For the most part, that's not a problem.
Right. That's only a problem if you're running your own game server in the demilitarized zone.
Right, or web server. The vast majority of people in their house never have a problem.
Right.
It's not usually an issue. So
if the modem is turned off in the power strip, it's not a big deal when you return everything on a few days later.
The only thing you have to remember is what order you turn things on in.
That's right.
And in terms of that, think of the internet feed coming in and turn things on in that order. The internet feed comes to your cable modem first, so turn that on.
Then wait.
And wait until it's actually on. Give it, 30 seconds or a minute. Then what happens next is it goes to your computer, so turn that on.
Might be a router in between.
If you've got your own router, then
turn
that
first.
On. Right.
Right.
So basically, if I turn on everything, everything's connected to the power strip. If I turn the power strip on, wait 30 seconds before turning the PC on.
Well, yes. If you've got the cable modem plugged directly into the computer.
I'm a bigger fan of turning things on individually if you can, rather than having them all switched on one power strip.
I would turn the cable modem on first.
Uh-huh.
Wait 30 seconds to a minute, and then turn on the computer.
Right.
Okay, the monitor will have power, but the monitor will kick on once the computer starts generating...
generating a signal.
Right. Don't worry about that. I'm thinking specifically in terms of getting on the network.
Right.
So the bottom line is this. For maybe overnight, not that big of a deal, but if you're going away, and I think one of you guys mentioned it, if you're going away for 3 or 4 days and unsure of the weather where there could be thunder and lightning, you certainly don't want to have a power surge knock something out or burn out something that...
At that point, unplug everything from the wall.
Yep.
Or what about just turning off the power strip?
Well,
because you've still got a copper connection to the power grid at that point, and whether or not the switch is off or not, you still have a potential...
I lost the computer that way.
Yeah.
Once.
If it's a powerful enough lightning strike, it'll jump that gap without a problem.
So, I put an air gap between you and the power grid where the lightning might affect everything.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your knowledge.
You're welcome.
Thanks
for calling. I do want to get this in. This actually isn't part of the news thing that I sent out.
All right. One other thing, on the electric front. The modern laptops are generally running at, 40 watts or 45 watts? So if you think about a 45-watt light bulb, not a 60-watt, but a 45-watt light bulb running, that's literally how much electricity you're using. And there are devices like a kilowatt, you can Google for that you can plug in, and it will tell you how much electricity your device is using. For the vast majority of things, leaving it on versus not leaving it on, in terms of dollars and cents, it's really pretty negligible.
Right. All right.
Want to take a call or do a story?
Yeah, let's take the call.
And then
we'll do the story.
We love phone calls.
We do love phone calls. Our next caller is Joe from Henrietta, New York. Welcome, Joe. What's up?
Hey, Nick. It's Joe from Brighton and Rochester and Henrietta. Oh, my.
Okay.
How are you?
I'm all over the place. In Fairport, I used to be from there.
Okay.
The that air gap thing, there might be a solution, a GFCI switch. I think that might provide an air gap. I'm not positive, but it might.
That's an interesting point. It's a lot cheaper to just unplug from the wall.
Yeah,
a lot cheaper. I can do that myself.
You can leave a GFCI in all the time.
Right.
Yeah, the ground fault circuit interruption, that type of outlet. Generally, generally, I hear about those the most anytime that you've got an outlet that's near water, whether it's a bathroom or a kitchen, and you're concerned that you might accidentally drop the hair dryer in the sink while you're blow drying your hair. I'm not sure that's the same type of situation. I think it's a ground fault is different than having an overvoltage. So that may not be entirely the same type of thing. There are surge suppressors that you can put in your breaker box that I just researched this week for a client. They're not terribly expensive. You'll need a professional to install them, but those are something you can also do. But again, surge suppressors don't last forever and eventually need to be replaced. They're essentially a shock absorber, and they do wear out over time.
What I use is an uninterruptible power supply.
I also use that.
And there are two types of those. There's the kind that essentially, and those of you who are electrical engineers will cringe at the way I put this, but this is a way to think of it conceptually. The power comes into the computer, and sitting off to the side is the battery waiting to jump in if there's an interruption in the power.
Yeah.
The second way it works is the power always comes into the battery directly, and the battery feeds the computer always. With that kind, with an inline power supply, if it gets a surge, again, maybe
you'll rely on the battery not exploding.
Well, you're relying on the battery not exploding, so it depends on how big that surge is. But batteries can handle awfully large surges. All you're really doing is giving them more power. So as a surge protector, I think they work better than a regular surge suppressor. And also, surges are less common than brownouts. Not enough electricity is way more common than too much.
Yes.
And having that inline uninterruptible power supply means your computer never notices that because it's always being fed by the battery. So the battery's either getting enough power to move on or it isn't, and then it's working as a battery.
Yeah.
Right? So that's my preference to any other solution is an inline power supply. And there's another fancier term for that. I'm sure my technoid friends will know what that is.
Yeah, call in if you know what it is.
I can't remember. Yeah. Well, it's a UPS, but there are two types, as I said.
Right. Well, yeah, it depends on how much money you're willing to lay down because, I mean, they can make either one for $50, but for more, they can make the one that works.
Right. And you can usually tell which, you're right, you can usually tell which kind they are by how much they cost. The more expensive ones are the ones you actually want.
I had one other thing to mention. I mentioned this to Dave last week on the phone, but he didn't get to put it on. Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee on Crackle.com. Heard of it?
Yes, I have. What's his name?
Mr. Seinfeld.
Mr. Seinfeld, that's exactly right. Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. That's right.
My favorite therapeutic episode is the David Letterman one with the Volvo with a Mustang engine a supercharger.
Yep. It's a pretty good show all the way around.
Yeah. That's the one huge benefit of the internet. They couldn't have done that without the internet.
Right. For those of you who don't know, Seinfeld has an online series called Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. And the title gives it away. It's they do.
It's fantastic.
And it is. It's fantastic. It's really well done. It's people just going to get coffee and chit-chatting, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, Jerry Seinfeld and some of his comedian friends that he invites. And Jerry's a car guy, so he always picks out a car that he thinks best encapsulates the spirit and the personality of the person that he's inviting to coffee. So he went out with Seth Meyers and got a 1970s Porsche 911, and he went out with Sarah Silverman and got, I don't remember precisely, but
I think it was a Saab or something.
Yes, that's right, because she's from New Hampshire or something.
Jaguar. It was a light blue Jaguar, which is very similar to a Saab, actually.
Right.
But it's a fantastic podcast. I do recommend that one. He's interviewed David Letterman, and David Letterman apparently was friends with Paul Newman, and Paul Newman got a Volvo station wagon and put a supercharged Ford engine in it that was just ridiculous. So it would blow away anything on the expressway.
Right.
So it was a lot of fun.
Okay. I think I have more to contribute, but I'll save it.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
All right. Take care.
Appreciate that. There's the stuff on YouTube now has become way more professional.
Oh yeah,
is the way to put it than it used to be. There are a lot of really good professional people who are doing stuff. There are people who've become YouTube stars, and there are people who were stars who've moved to YouTube.
Right,
which is an entirely different set of phenomena.
Right. Yeah, there's all sorts of people that have been sort of kicked out or shunned from traditional mainstream media that have found an audience. And I think that probably started with the satellite radio people, and then it's kind of grown from there. But the cost to develop your own studio and to get the hardware that it takes to record people is down so much, and the distribution costs are so low that it's real easy to do that and then start getting a couple of advertisers, and before you know it, you've got an actual legitimate business.
Yep, that's exactly right.
So it's amazing.
All right. We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dennis Worster, with Michael Oden, with me, Nick Francesco, and you. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. We're going to come back with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites, right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dennis Worster.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And I really want to get to this because I actually was asked to talk about it at some point. Federal authorities said on Wednesday that they had arrested a San Francisco man accused of running an online marketplace for illegal drugs and other illicit goods. Users of the Silk Road website made purchases using Bitcoin.
Yes, that's why I heard about it.
Yep, a digital currency that helped mask their identity. People buying drugs with Bitcoin. Fascinating. Nice. During the past 4 years, the value of Bitcoins in circulation has exceeded $1 billion. That's billion with a B, dollars. And the currency is widely used around the world. The arrest of Silk Road's alleged founder, Ross William Ulbricht, and the shutdown of the site threw the market into disarray.
Can I get that name one more time?
Ross William Ulbricht.
Thank you.
Certainly. The value of the virtual currency plummeted minutes after the FBI announced that it had shut down the site. Silk Road's closure meant that users would lose any bitcoins they deposited. That includes about $300 that the nonprofit Digital Citizens Alliance purchased as part of its own investigation of the industry. The Silk Road case could be a blow to one of Bitcoin's greatest selling points, its reputation for secrecy. That reputation was central to Silk Road's ability to operate into Bitcoin itself. But the federal investigation that led to Ulbricht's arrest shows that even purchases made with anonymous profiles on an anonymous site are still trackable. How many times have we said that on this show? Nothing is anonymous on the internet.
Yes, TNO, trust no one.
Exactly. This goes to show you that though this is an anonymous currency, if you use it for illegal purposes, you will get caught. However, that crack in anonymity could turn out to be a positive thing for Bitcoin, particularly among those who want to shed its reputation as the currency of choice for seedy online activities. The FBI shuttered Silk Road and seized approximately 26,000 Bitcoins worth about $3.6 million. It marks the largest Bitcoin seizure in history, according to the complaint filed in the Southern District of New
York. It's still not enough to reopen the federal government.
Exactly.
I've always wondered
that.
We
can run the government on Bitcoin.
Why can't the NSA use all their supercomputers and just calculate Bitcoins?
Exactly. During its 2 years, 2.5 years in operation, Silk Road's been used by several thousand drug dealers and other unlawful vendors to distribute hundreds of kilograms of illegal drugs and illicit goods and services to well over 100,000 buyers, the indictment states. It says that 600,000 bitcoins changed hands on the site, which at current exchange rates translates to about $3.6 billion. In addition to narcotics, Silk Road listed fake driver's licenses, counterfeit currency, hacking services, and much more, the government alleges.
That's a fantastic mall, isn't it?
Yeah.
It got everything. It's like some crazy Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah.
You just wander around. Hey, what do you need, man? I'll get you anything you need.
Anything you need. Listen, if you ever used Bitcoin, give us a call. Not for illicit.
No,
we're
no,
not
no,
going to
no.
ask you what you've used it for.
And,
just
and what's your address?
Bitcoin, exactly. Yes. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Just like Victor did. And Arondacoit, New York. Hiya, Victor. What's up?
Hey, Nick. Nick, I used Revo Uninstaller to uninstall what I thought was all the remnants of our old printer. And we installed a new printer, and the new one works great. But when you go to devices and printers, it's still there. So I right-clicked on it, deleted it, and I went back into the program again, and it's still there again after I deleted it. Is there any way I can permanently delete it?
Wow. The problem is likely that you did things backwards.
Oh.
You needed to remove them from the device manager first and then take any remnants out with Revo Uninstaller. Revo Uninstaller works great for software, but hardware puts stuff in extra places.
You're right. That's exactly what I did. I did Revo first and then tried to... I was just checking it on the devices
yep,
and printers.
Yep,
I was surprised
that's fine.
It was still there.
Yep.
Because Windows it makes that printer available to you in that device list, and then in behind the scenes is taking that driver and linking it so that when you say print in whatever application you are, it knows
right.
to send and hand that off to the driver. And I think probably Revo did a good job probably uninstalling the driver, but I don't think it knows how or chose to
right, it doesn't
unlink it
right.
from the device list.
So I don't know at this moment quite what to tell you, since it the way the device manager works is it's going to look to uninstall the driver. Since it can't, as that driver's no longer there, it won't uninstall the link because it thinks there's an error in itself rather than, yeah, the thing's not
just
there anymore.
Just a thought. When I've uninstalled printers and something similar has happened to me, I've gone into my computer, found the file that the printer is in, and deleted that, and it's normally gotten rid of it.
Oh, okay.
That might work. Be very careful what you delete. Don't delete anything. Just move it somewhere else. The other thing you could do, now you've turned your computer off and on since this time, right?
Oh, many times.
Yeah. You're gonna have to go into the devices area and find it there and do something with it at that point. I'm sorry.
Or do a reinstall, deinstall.
Reinstall might keep. Well, it can't hurt.
It might take some time. But.
Right, it takes some time. But if you do a reinstall, it may just pick up the same device that's already in there.
You're talking about reinstall the old printer, right?
Right. Reinstall the drivers and stuff for that.
The only bad thing about that for me is it's shredded. I mean, when we got rid of the printer, I shredded the disk.
I see. You could probably get the driver from their website.
Yeah,
but...
you might want to just give it a try. You know what you want to do? Go into that device, and you should be able to reinstall the driver right in the device. And have it look on the network, on the internet for the device driver, and see if it will reinstall the driver directly from the network. And if it does that, you should, or if not, you should be able to download the, if it's a printer anytime in the last 15 years, you should be able to download the driver from the manufacturer's website. Reinstall the driver into that same device. Then delete the device. Then do Revo Uninstaller.
All right, so now just reinstall it again, then, basically.
Well, but reinstall the driver.
Driver
go into
right,
that
yeah.
actual device and okay. tell it to update the driver, right, and tell it to look on the internet. And if it can't find it there, then download the driver and tell it again to update it, but look in this folder.
Because then I go back to devices and printers and then delete that, then do Revo?
There you go.
Okay, I can do that.
All righty.
All right, thanks, Nick.
Sure.
Goodbye.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to do that.
Yeah, I suspect so.
But back to this Bitcoin thing.
Yeah, I've always wanted to use Bitcoin, and I've wanted to mine my own, but even I found it way too complicated.
Well, yes. You either have to join a marketplace where you spend a lot of money to get some money.
Yeah.
Or you...
Like a currency exchange is
right,
what you mean, right?
Right, okay. Right.
Or you hand him $100 and you get something less than $100 worth of Bitcoin.
Right,
of
exactly.
Fees.
And then, or you can calculate Bitcoins.
Right, where you run an app on your computer and through the magic of encryption and high-speed calculations, you're able to win the auction for the Bitcoins that have been cast out from the
But those are fewer and far between these days.
Well, yeah. I mean, they keep upping the difficulty level.
Right.
And
so if you've got a fairly high-end machine
this week
that you're doing nothing with otherwise.
Yeah. And somebody else is paying for your electricity.
Well, yeah. and your heat or your air conditioning, rather.
Right.
So for those of you who don't know, Bitcoin is exactly that. It's an in the web monetary system, and you either can buy Bitcoins or you can calculate them. And as Dennis said, what happens is you're calculating.
It's essentially a very hard math problem.
Yeah, it's just a math problem. It doesn't have anything to do with Bitcoins itself. It's just a math problem.
Right. And every so often, the organizers of the Bitcoin network put out a certain number of prizes. And those prizes are that you can pull back and get a Bitcoin if you are the first computer to solve that particular problem that has been flagged as being one that wins a Bitcoin.
Right.
And your computer's going to spend a lot of time calculating, but you may not necessarily win one. So a lot of people will get together and join a group, and the group will all work on a block of problems together. And if anyone in the group wins a Bitcoin, then you all split it.
So it's like a grand prize lottery type thing, right?
Right, yeah. So if anybody wins that, then you split it. So you might get some tiny little fraction of a Bitcoin.
But if you do that often enough, you end up with a Bitcoin.
Right. So the value of, how many dollars is a Bitcoin? Is a Bitcoin a dollar? Is a Bitcoin $3? Is a Bitcoin 20 cents? Well, that changes all the time because it is a currency, and it was at one point listed on a currency exchange, and I'm sure that you can track the value of that. I'm sure if you Google for it, if you say like $1 in Bitcoin, I bet you'll get that. Nick's having issues with his laptop. I think he's about to get out the sledgehammer and do some percussive maintenance on this thing.
Exactly. That's what I just did.
So what's the value?
Here we go. Bitcoin exchange rate.
Okay.
One Bitcoin is $121.5.
Hmm. Okay. So if I had 1/100th of a Bitcoin, I'd have $1.20.
$1.20.
Okay. So then we've got to figure out how much do I have to spend on electricity and air conditioning to generate that? And the answer is...
Or how much of the Amazon cloud do I have to purchase...
Yeah, right.
...to buy Bitcoins? It could be that you... You know what? It could be that you're making money if
maybe,
you do that right.
Maybe. Yeah, there's a lot of... As that difficulty level goes up, it takes longer with a given piece of hardware to calculate a potentially winning algorithm. So it's the kind of thing that is still really in its infancy. It's only become popular, I'd say, in the past... 9 or 10 months. It's been around much longer than that, but it was kind of the thing that only underground people who are really, really into this sort of thing would even attempt.
Right. And I've actually seen people talk about how they've built essentially a distributed network of cheap computers like
that's one way.
Arduinos or the little $35 one. What's that called?
Raspberry Pi. Yep.
Yeah. A distributed network of those to solve for Bitcoins.
The things that I've seen is that there are a lot more what we call ASICs, application-specific integrated circuits.
Yep, and that works too.
And people are building those and trying to make sure that they end up making more money overall than they're spending in electricity. That's the gigantic calculation that people are trying to balance. And as the problems become more difficult, that number increases, so it takes longer to get, so it takes more resources to produce.
Right, and I've seen most of the people I've seen doing that are in labs and computers in colleges, so they're not paying for the electricity.
No, this is not necessarily your neighbor. It's something he's doing.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller, we've got a couple minutes to talk to George from Greece. Hiya, George. What's up?
Good morning, fellas.
Hello.
I have a question for you. I hear a lot of talk about people being flooded with email messages, and there are various detectors looking for so-called spam. I was wondering, is there a software available that takes the other approach? That is, I could put in a list of addresses that I consider high priority and separate those into a special section so that when I review my email, I work on the important ones first.
Yes, you can. One of the things that is available is you've heard of blacklists. That's where you put all your spam. Uh-huh. The thing you're talking about is a whitelist.
Yes.
And they are available. I've actually created my own. I use Thunderbird for my email. And what I've done is I've created a filter. If you're not in my address book, I change the color of the email to purple.
Okay.
So all the ones I see in black are people I know.
The text color, you mean?
The text color of the header in the...
Uh-huh. In the listing.
In the listing. So when I go through my email, I see all the ones in black. They stand out more than the purple ones because the purple text is a little lighter.
Uh-huh.
So I see all the black ones, and those are people I know and who are in my address book, and I answer those. Then I can go through the purple ones and mostly just delete them.
Right.
But that way, I've essentially created my own sort of list.
So I'm impressed because you can do it with your ability. Is there something that's commercially available, or are you using a feature within that software package that I'm not aware of?
I'm using a feature inside Thunderbird.
Okay.
I created a filter.
Yep. And you can do that with a lot of different tools. I know in the Apple world, we've got Apple's application called Mail that will do filters and do coloring. I do that. I make sure that all the email from my clients is green. For obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And I also have in the most recent version, and we'll talk about this when we come back, but there's a thing called a VIP list, and we'll talk more about what a VIP list is and what it can do after the break.
So, George, hang on the phone. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue answering this question. Is that a deal?
I'll hang on. Thank you.
Excellent. We're going to take a slightly longer break. It's the end of our first hour of the show, but don't worry, you've got a whole nother hour of this torture ahead of you. So stay tuned. It's Dennis Worster, it's Michael Oden, it's me, Nick Francesco, and it's you. And it's 59 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest running computer show in the known universe. We have George on the line from Greece, and you can join the fun too by giving us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Sound bites right here on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back to America's longest running computer show, Sound Bites, on member supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dennis Worster.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 2 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites, and we have George from Greece on the line.
And I'm George on the line.
There you go.
Thanks, George.
And Dennis was going to tell you about one way to do this whitelisting business.
That's right. So the whitelisting business is that essentially you are creating a list of people that you want to hear from, and you're essentially ignoring everybody else rather than the concept of keeping track of things that might be spam and filtering those away and then dealing with what's left. The spam filter is always going to catch something you didn't intend or fail to catch something that you really wanted it to.
Right.
And a VIP list is a good way to create a whitelist or a list of people that you definitely want to hear from. Nick was talking about how an app called Mozilla Thunderbird will let you create filters that say, if the sender of the message that I just received is in my address book, then do the following. And doing the following could be make a different chime when that type of email arrives, or it could be make it show up in a different color. On the Mac, in the Apple world, we have the concept of what's called the VIP list, and VIPs is a list that's in Apple's mail program, and when you add people to it, you get a special listing in the left column where all of your folders are, and that is a listing of mail specifically from these people that you've designated.
Right. We should ask, and I apologize for not doing this, what is your mail system? Where do you get your mail?
My email comes in through Outlook, but I'm asking for a business person who is flooded with this information, and it leads me to the way I want to discuss this a little more with you and Dennis. You fellows have done a good job of describing the principles and kind of from the originator or the software side, but for someone who is not tech savvy and who might be willing to pay some person to come in and do this, is this something that is generally being made available through software contractors?
Oh, yeah.
Most of them can do this. Yeah.
Any consultant worth his salt can set up a mail filter for you. That's not a difficult challenge.
So if I were to ask this business person to make an inquiry and talk about, say, a whitelist or some other type of VIP sorting,
right,
that would be enough that the...
The magic phrase is whitelist. That's the one you want to use.
Yeah, that's the common industry term. And also, if he or she has someone they use normally for their tech work, they're probably best off asking them specifically because they'll know the system that they're using and everything else.
Any other magic details that might not be apparent to someone.
Bottom line is it's very doable. It is very easy under most mail systems. Mm-hmm. And dang near every consultant I've ever met knows how to do this.
Okay. That's good information. I think this person is going to be very interested. So
excellent.
Other listeners will pick up on it as well.
There you go.
I have not heard a caller call in about this type of solution. Would you say that you hear about them from time to time, or is it pretty rare?
Actually, they're fairly common.
But we usually see it the other way. I've got all this spam. What do I do about it?
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
And I just wonder if callers would think about the other end of that spectrum, that's a lot more workable.
It can be, as long as the people that you deal with, that population of people is relatively stable. If you're only dealing with the same two dozen people, then that's fine. But if new people come into your group or new people want to make contact with you, then you become harder to find.
Well, your argument is sound, except that that's working in that direction. That's worth an investment because you keep getting better. It doesn't mean you won't search through the other items. The person is no worse off than they would have been before you started your whitelist.
Right. Really, what you want are three lists.
Yeah.
This is my whitelist, this is my blacklist, and this is the people who aren't in either of the other two.
I think that's good advice. I like that.
Yeah, that's what you really want.
Okay. Plus, there's a whole lot of smart people out there. They're going to try to out-trick you, but let them get into the B and C list, so...
Right, right. By doing it directly by email address, you skip all the other nonsense of people gaming the system with what they put in the email.
Right.
Okay. Very good. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for giving us a call.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, we're seeing it used more often nowadays.
Well, yeah, 90%+ of the world's email is spam, so we're interested in filtering that out. And I do both. You know, I will filter out the spam. I've switched over to using Gmail as my internet provider for years and years ago, and they make it easy to filter lots and lots of spam. And then I use their whitelist features to make sure that the people I care about get their messages read first. And for sometimes that's family and friends, and sometimes that's people who make my life possible and pay my mortgage and my car payments. So we try and make sure that we provide them with excellent service, of course.
That's how it works. All right, back to the phones. It's Joe from Cheek.
Tawaga.
There it is.
What can we do for you, Joe?
Well, so many things to say.
I'm sorry, did we surprise you by taking your call? Is that what happened?
Start at the beginning.
I kind of like Gmail. It has a very nice filtering facility. I think the thing that works best for people, most people, is to have the whitelist you talked about. to make sure those who you correspond with regularly do get through, and then use Bayesian filtering after that. And that's the junk filtering built into things like Thunderbird.
Right.
Because there are some senders that will not conform to any pattern. They'll do it basically based on some message ID. I don't know why exactly they do this, but they'll have some big long hash CS, you know, for customer service at mybank.com or whatever.
Right.
And it's difficult to filter on that because it's variable every time you receive something from them.
Well, the Bayesian filtering really works on the body of the message nowadays.
Yeah, it's a statistical...
Yeah, definitely.
For listeners who might not know what the heck we're talking about, there was a statistician called Bayes, or named Bayes, and that was his last name, and he developed a concept of being able to analyze large bodies of data and being able to filter them. And I'm glossing over lots and lots of details here, but this... this was recently applied to the concept of spam messages so that you can see what type of messages tend to be spam, and you can kind of flag those and you sort of teach the system. And then it kind of uses that approach and that statistical analysis to figure out, based on what it has learned, given incoming messages, what is likely to be spam. And that is a very flexible approach that works not only just on keeping track of the sender's address, but also keeping track of the type of message you're receiving and the body content.
Right. So you end up, that's why I advocate three lists. You have your black list, which is based on a Bayesian filter. So it figures out from the body of the text that somebody's trying to sell you Viagra. You have the white list, which is based on an email address, which is just, these are the people in my address book. And then you have the gray list, which is, I don't know, they don't fit the other two lists, we'll put them in here. So if you do black list first, then white list, then the remainder gets dumped in the gray list, you catch a vast majority, you know, nothing is ever perfect, but you catch a vast majority more than you would just by going off of only the email address or only the Bayesian filter or whatever. Because, you know, if a friend of mine makes a joke about, I don't know, one of us needs Viagra these days, I want to get the joke rather than have it go into
right
my blacklist area.
Yep, so you have to look at things from multiple
right
angles.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, it takes a while for the Bayesian filter to realize what is junk to you and what is good to you.
Right, and that's why you should always mark things that you receive as junk. Mark them as junk. Don't just throw them away. Mark them as junk, then throw them away, so your system will know that it is junk.
Right, and you can run Bayesian software on your computer itself, or if you are a Gmail subscriber, then when you flag messages, your notes about what spam get added to a vast database about what everyone else thinks is spam as well. And their system, you know, quickly learns how to block those similar messages. And the more people in the community start flagging things, the smarter that system gets. So it's kind of a crowdsourcing approach to figuring out what spam looks like.
Right. Go ahead.
Believe it or not, they apply that to Google Voice as well. It's like, I guess they figure out from what phone numbers the spam voicemails are coming from, because
yep,
that's a feature. You can join that too if you want.
Yep.
Yes, it's true.
Yep. And I have cut down considerably on the amount of crap phone calls I get nowadays.
We need to talk about this because I'm getting several a day.
There's two things. Are you getting them through Google Voice or are you getting them direct?
No, I'm getting them direct through my Frontier supplied line.
Okay, here's what you do.
I'm listening.
You create, I did this years ago. I don't get many of these anymore until my wife changed. Here. What you do is you have an answering machine.
Okay.
And you can download from the internet those three tones that mean this phone is out of service.
Uh-huh.
Do, do, do.
Uh-huh.
When you get automated calls, if they hear that tone, they drop you from their list because they don't want to waste the time
sure
calling dead numbers.
Yeah, right.
So you make that the start of your answering machine message.
Okay, so it'll play do-do-do, and then I say, hey, wasn't that a cool sound? By the way, I'm not here, leave a message.
Yeah, just ignore the sound. Yeah, do-do-do, thanks for calling, we're not here, leave a message.
Huh.
Humans will go, that was weird, but they'll leave the message.
Right.
Machines will go, oh, dead number, and take you off the list.
It's like those nightly news chimes that you'd hear on the...
Exactly. So when you do that, when we did that, we ended up with zero for about a year and a half. Then, of course, my wife changed the message, and now they're building up again, so I got to change the message and add it back again.
I'm going to try this.
That worked. That worked for me. And, of course, if you do it through Google Voice, you can turn on their filtering, and it'll handle it for
right,
you.
Right, right. I'm totally doing it this afternoon.
There you go. It takes a while.
Okay.
Because, you know, there's a thousand of these companies.
Right. Yeah.
But each one will start dropping you off your list.
Yes. You know, Melissa from Cardholder Services needs to stop calling me.
Yeah. I can't remember. There is a Wikipedia page on it that has sound files of all those call progress tones. And what you want is the intercept tone, the one that's marked intercept.
Yep.
Because that's the name for it. There's other ones that sound similar. But they're not quite the same. The unfortunate thing is, though, I did that on voicemail once, and I got people like hanging up. They thought, oh, I just dialed wrong or something. So they're just like, you know, spam filtering. There is a little risk in doing that.
Yes,
unfortunately.
Yes, there is, but it works extremely well about 99% of the time. I'm happy with that number.
Oh, it is pretty wonderful. As a matter of fact, there's a couple of VoIP companies that I know of. They have that as a feature of their voicemail. You can toggle it on, and you know, anybody that leaves a message, it plays that intercept tone, and away you go. It does shut off most of the junk calls.
Yep.
Now, the other thing I wanted to kind of say about the guy that was that wanted to leave his computer on while he goes on vacation or whatever.
Yep.
That's right. To be the safest, you definitely totally unplug. Just don't switch off the
power strip. Right.
Yeah, totally unplug that power strip from the wall, and that will afford you the most protection.
That's right. You want to see those prongs.
Yep.
The guy that was talking about GFCI.
Yeah.
It's really rather minimal what that'll do for you.
Right.
Really,
right.
What a ground fault is the electricity. It goes out through the, well, very simplified, but the electricity that goes out through the one prong makes its way somewhere else, like through a person to ground, and doesn't make enough of it, doesn't make it back in the other prong. That's what a ground fault is. And really, for surges, it's not really the same, what would you call it, problem space.
Right, exactly. It's solving a different problem.
Oh, yes, definitely. You might try a... the name is this. They call it something like spark fault. It's a very new type of device. The idea is it's arc fault. That's it. Arc fault circuit interrupter. They're starting to require those in new construction for bedrooms. I don't quite know why, but it's trying to detect a circuit arcing and shut off the current before this arc turns into a fire,
right. Basically.
And along the same lines, I've heard of another type of UPS. They call it line interactive. The basic premise there is if you go over voltage or under voltage, it can compensate a little bit within a certain range. If it goes outside the range or you get cut off completely, then it switches over to battery. So,
well, yeah, that's the one I was talking about, the inline. I call it inline. I don't know the technical terms, but it's the one that actually puts the battery in between the outlet and the device.
Online, yes. Most of the UPS manufacturers call that online, where it's constantly converting from AC to battery, then battery back to AC. That's another class entirely.
All right, we got more people on the line, Joe. Thank you very much.
See ya.
Have fun. All right, our next caller. Oh, no, I don't know who our next caller is. That's my fault.
That's all right.
Poor Michael, he's actually apparently much busier than I think he is.
He's
and
juggling everything.
He's doing talking. All the hard work, and I know
that. There's lights flashing and knobs going
and
sliders sliding.
It all right now. And,
I'm pretty impressed, really.
Yep, our next caller is Joel from Pittsford. Hiya, Joel. What's up?
Hi, guys. Thanks for another great show.
Thanks.
I know Steve's not there, but I know he'd want everybody to know this. The Cider Help Sessions I guess they call them Q&As.
Yes, that's right.
Now moving, starting next Saturday, they'll be at the Tech Age Computer Learning Center at the JCC from 3 to 5. And Steve will be there answering all kinds of questions on all kinds of Apple devices. And I think he'd want everybody to know that session has moved. It's the second Saturday of every month from 3 to 5, now at the JCC.
That sounds fantastic.
Yep. Thanks.
Steve provides a valuable customer service. He answers your questions, to, as far as I'm aware, free of charge.
Oh, yeah.
And all you have to do is show up and ask, and he'll tell you what he thinks based on his years and years of experience. It's a fantastic place. So that's Saturday at the JCC.
Yeah, we've talked about this more than once. Poor Steve. I get it, too, but I don't own a shop. But Steve and Dave, they answer free questions at user groups. They answer questions free here. They answer questions free a lot of other places. So people don't seem to have a problem of walking into their stores where they earn a living
right.
and asking for free stuff.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we don't do it in the shop.
That's right.
The amazing thing is that I have not seen Steve stumped yet.
No, he's got encyclopedic knowledge about very, very many things.
And super fast Googling fingers, if all
pretty
else
amazing.
Fails.
And thank you all for all you do.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling, Joel.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it. Thanks. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dennis Worster. I beg your pardon, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and assuming that I live through this, and you, it is 20 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We're Soundbites, right here, on the truly great and truly member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
Hola! Welcome! I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dennis Worster.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 25 minutes after the, I don't know, it sounded like some sort of bullfighting music.
I know, suddenly I wanted tacos.
Exactly. All right, we're going to...
I'm like, what are you doing?
We're going to wander far afield nowadays, and we're going to talk to Christian from Hartford, Connecticut. Are you actually in Hartford, Connecticut?
Yes. Formerly Christian of Rochester, but...
Now Christian... Well, welcome back to America. What can we do for you?
Well, a few things. You were talking about the email filtering, and I use Spam Assassin myself, but
sure.
I don't use the Bayesian component of that. There's kind of like an online database of spam,
right?
Pizar and Razor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
so that seems to work pretty good. I don't know if there's a plugin for those.
Are those the real time black hole lists?
Yeah. So they have checksums of all the spam addresses.
Right.
I don't know if there's like a plugin for Thunderbird for that, but
I believe there is. I know there's a plugin for Spam Assassin directly, and once you've got that, you can pretty much get everything else.
Right. So just for our listeners, real-time black hole list is when your device notices that a lot of spam is coming out of one particular sending server, then you keep track of that, and you submit that thing that you noticed to a central repository called a list, and it's called a black hole list because everyone who submits to these things can also subscribe to them, and you keep track of if your mail you're receiving is coming from one of these bad guys, and then you just kind of drop any messages because they are more likely to be spam.
Some of them are content-based, too.
That's right.
Right. Well, Spam Assassin does, like you said, RBL testing, which is a blacklist testing. It does Bayesian analysis, and it also does header and body text analysis of its own. It's really designed. Originally, it was designed to use with a product called Procmail, which processes your mail. But nowadays,
yeah, I use it from that.
Right, but nowadays it also works with a lot of mail transport agents, which is the technical term for programs like Thunderbird.
Right, or Apple's Mail, or Eudora, right. Or any of the other Outlook or Outlook Express.
Right.
The tools that you use to look at your mail. And Spam Assassin has been around for a long time, years and years, pretty much as long as the concept of Bayesian filtering has been around, and probably longer than that.
Yep.
So it's an effective tool.
Yeah, I don't know if it's possible to use it from Apple Mail, but I run a local mail server, so I do it.
Right, you do
globally,
it directly there,
yeah.
Right, through
yep.
Procmail.
Sure. There's a similar implementation. That's a product called Spam Sieve that's available for the Mac, and that works nicely with Apple's Mail.
Right.
Okay.
Excellent.
Okay, now you were talking about the special tone you can play for the telemarketers.
Yes, tell me more.
Well, they've annoyed me quite a bit. So, rather than just dropping them, I prefer to send them to a special recording where I just kind of try to hang them for as long as I can.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, but
no,
they win when you do that. I know telemarketers.
Yeah, you're costing them money. That's the best.
Well, you're costing them money, but you're also keeping them on the line, and that's what they want. They don't look at how successful the call was. One of the things they look at, obviously, is how successful the call was. They also look at how long the telemarketer kept the person on the line. Yeah, they do. They really
do. But if it doesn't generate a sale at the end of all that time, then, their average sales per hour for
the
that
most,
person is
right, the
down.
Most important thing is average sales per hour, but keeping people on the line is also one of their metrics.
It records them, and then it provides for some entertainment value.
Yes, I can understand that. I used to keep them on the line all the time. I would chat with them forever. And then when they asked me for a credit card, I would always say, oh, I'm not allowed to have a credit card. Oh, no, I can't. They won't let me.
The doctor said.
Well, I don't do it personally. I don't even hear it ring. It goes directly to a separate recording based on the caller ID.
Oh, right, right.
Clever.
It just repeats forever, saying various things. And
very nice. Very nice.
All right.
You were also asking if anyone had used Tor, I think.
No, we were talking Bitcoin, but Tor is the same idea, sure. It's a thing to – it's an anonymizer. And so conceptually, Bitcoins are supposed to be anonymous. Tor is supposed to be anonymous.
Yeah, I mean, I tried it just, for the fun of going to watch my IP and seeing it like somewhere in Asia or something like
Right.
But if you go to Google, it's almost impossible because so many people are using the same exit node. You instantly get one of those. We think you're sending automated queries. Please fill out the
right.
capture or whatever. And by the time you do that, there's been 1,000 other queries, so you can never.
Right, Tor is what they call an anonymizer, and what it does is it hides your IP address
right.
from the recipient. Of course, it's not really an anonymizer. There have been at least a half a dozen cases just in this year alone of bad guys being caught through their Tor. Anonymized
right.
Tor queries.
Instead of buying an airplane ticket and giving the airplane company your first and last name and your address, imagine if you could just walk over to your local manhole and flip up the lid and jump in and end up popping out somewhere in Asia or in India. And that's the general concept, that suddenly you can move things around without necessarily being tracked.
Right, except you can be tracked.
Yes, Tor. Yes.
There is no anonymous.
To use it now, with
yeah,
all
exactly.
stuff going on. You probably get some kind of
negative attention. Yes.
Yeah, that's who they're looking
the NSA
at first.
Is watching you.
Right, that's who they're looking at first.
You notice
right.
they didn't defund the NSA.
Yeah, right.
Well, no. The defense person did say that the NSA is only working at 70% capacity.
Right,
and I'm sure that's plenty.
Right, but you'll notice that they don't take down things like Tor.
No, why would you take it down when you can monitor it?
Exactly.
Right. All right, well, thanks, guys.
Thanks,
great
Christian.
Show.
Have fun in Hartford. Someday maybe you can come home.
Okay, yeah. Bye.
Hartford, Connecticut. Nice. It's actually a very nice place.
I'd like to go there.
It's a lovely town. It's a lovely town. I've been there several times, and I enjoyed it very much. Very pretty. Now, this time of year in particular.
Oh, sure.
Very, very pretty.
Leaf peepers.
Yeah, very, very nice. So it's a good place to be. It's a good place to, if you can get out of the city itself, and wander through some of the hills and stuff over there. It's very, very pretty.
All right. You got another news story for us?
I do. I have an interesting news story. Three of the top 20 investors in Microsoft Corporation are lobbying the board to press for Bill Gates to step down as chairman of the software company he co-founded 38 years ago. While Microsoft chief executive Steve Ballmer has been under pressure for years to improve the company's performance and share price, this appears to be the first time that major shareholders are taking aim at Gates, who remains one of the most respected and influential figures in technology. There is no indication that Microsoft's board would heed the wishes of the three investors, who collectively hold more than 5% of the company's stock. Gates owns about 4.5% of the $277 billion, that's billion with a B, dollar company, and is its largest individual shareholder. The three investors are concerned that Gates' presence on the board effectively blocks the adoption of new strategies and would limit the power of a new chief executive to make substantial changes. In particular, they point to Gates' role on the special committee searching for Ballmer's successor. They are also worried that Gates, who spends most of his time on his philanthropic foundation, wields power out of proportion to his declining shareholding. Gates, who owes 49% of Microsoft before it went public in 1986, sells about 80 million Microsoft shares a year. By the way, if you just go to Google and type MSFT and hit enter,
right,
it will tell you the current share price.
I'll do that while you're
And
while
Gates
you're
sells 80 million shares a year under a preset plan, which, if continued, will leave him with no financial stake in the company by 2018. Gates lowered his profile at Microsoft after he handed the CEO role to Ballmer in 2000, giving up his day-to-day work in 2008 to focus on the $38 billion Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. In August, Ballmer said he would retire within 12 months amid pressure from activist fund manager Value Act Capital Management. Microsoft is now looking for a new CEO. I'm available. Though its board has said Ballmer's strategy would go forward, he has focused on making devices such as a Surface tablet and Xbox gaming console and turning key software into services provided over the Internet. Some investors say that a new chief should not be bound by that strategy, although I personally think it's a pretty good strategy.
Hmm.
Microsoft is still one of the world's most valuable technology companies, making a net profit of $22 billion last fiscal year. But its core Windows computing operating system, and to a lesser extent the Office software suite, are under pressure from the decline in personal computers as smartphones and tablets grow more popular. So should Gates resign from the board? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
Why should he have to? It's his company.
Not
They're
anymore.
All like, he wields too much influence. It's he created the company. He's still the founder regardless of
He's the
how
founder,
much stock
but the
he
minute
holds.
A company goes public, the
it's
shareholders own the company.
And he is only
4%. That's a simple fact, and he only
but
has
4.5%
of it.
Steve Jobs. I mean,
well,
Steve Jobs was kicked out of Apple, and he came back and...
Yeah, but he was still the stockholders were happy with him for two reasons. One is the cult of Jobs, but more importantly, he really did amazing stuff.
Really,
you know, had he done crap, he'd have been gone again. That's the way it works in a publicly held company. Publicly held company, the owners are the stockholders, and the customer is also the stockholder.
Can be.
It is. The whole point of a publicly traded company is to make money for the shareholders. That's what it's for.
Right.
It does that by selling computers or selling software or selling widgets, but that's incidental to the fact that it's there to make money for the shareholder. That is the customer. That's business 101. If you don't know that, get out of business.
Yep. So a bit of real-time follow-up here. Microsoft is currently trading at a little under $34 a share. So 80 million shares at $40 a pop.
Yep. That's not bad money right there.
No. 80 million of those, and soon you're talking about real money at some point here.
That's exactly right. That's what, 800 million? What is it, $40 a share? And he's selling what, 40 shares?
80 million a year at $34 each.
Yeah.
Fire up your HP calculators, people,
yeah.
And
yeah, exactly.
Do the math. It's got a lot of commas in it. That's all you need to know.
It's not when you get that much money, it's about how many commas there are,
that's
not
right.
What the numbers are. Anything over three commas is enough.
That you'd think so.
Yeah.
I've heard the people that run these kind of companies that they really love what they do, and they're mostly in it for the excitement of doing it, and the money is just how they keep score.
Yep, that's exactly right.
And then when a number gets to where they like it, they leave and...
Well, they can. It depends what their goal is. You know,
yep.
Some people get so excited about developing and producing products that's the payoff for them, is being able to build great things and show them to people.
Yep.
And other people want to be able to ride it in and get their shares to vest and then bail out and try and do something else.
And Microsoft has a problem, and they've had it for a number of years now. Back in the day when there were just personal computers, and they were building up to that 90% market share, actually 96% at one point.
Yeah, before all the computers were necessarily connected.
Right. Back when it was at 96% of the total desktop share, they were making money hand over fist. When they reached 96%, they realized they had a problem. There were no new markets.
Right. They had to grow that pie.
Again.
Yeah.
So you have, once you've sold everybody the operating system and everybody your office suite, what's next?
You have to sell them a different kind of device.
Or you resell into the same market.
Right.
But that's a cannibal. Apple has that problem now, too.
They do.
But what happened was they missed the internet. Bill Gates missed the internet completely. And woke up one morning to discover that people didn't need Windows anymore and didn't need Office anymore. I can buy a Chromebook for $200 and do every single thing. If I'm a high-end business guy, no, I have to have something else. But for the average person, I can do everything I want to do all day long on a Chromebook and never miss anything.
And never hand Microsoft a dollar.
Never hand anybody a dollar beyond my initial outlay for the hardware.
That's
200
right.
bucks.
Sure.
Or 250 in my case. I bought the fancy one. I bought the Samsung. I bought the Sammy. I love it.
They're fantastic little machines.
They're amazing. But the point is, I now pay zero money to Microsoft, zero money to Apple, zero money to Google beyond my initial investment.
Yeah, well, you are the product to Google.
I am the product to Google.
You're the person who advertises. You get advertised to, and you supply them information to target that.
Right. And it costs me no money. Right.
All those advertisers are buying it for you.
And you paid Apple for essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
But nobody's buying Microsoft Surface, Microsoft Dart. I mean, no, comparatively, they've got like 3% of the marketplace, I think it is
now. They've got a new version out that looks really impressive, but they're still growing.
Yes.
They're still growing.
Well, and that's the thing. We have to take a break, but I will say this. Microsoft loses and loses and loses, and then they win.
That's right.
That's always been the way it works. Taking a break. Back in just a couple of minutes. Soundbites. As 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dennis Wurster.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Do we want to talk about the free wireless plan?
Do that one.
All right. We'll talk about the free wireless, or do we want to talk about Brightspot? Now we'll talk about the free wireless plan. Freedom Pop, a promiser of free data, is finally launching the first actually free service plan into beta on Tuesday. It comes with free texts, free minutes, and free data. All you have to do is front $100 for the phone. We first heard about Freedom Pop's free wireless service aspirations earlier this year, and now the details in the beta have finally arrived. The biggest piece of the puzzle we were missing until now was the phone. It's the HTC Evo Design 4G WiMAX running Android 4.0, which is kind of meh. But it's only $100 and the service is free, which is slightly less meh. As you can probably tell by the name, these handsets slurp up 4G data by piggybacking on Sprint's WiMAX instead of LTE, but Sprint's WiMAX coverage is actually better than its fledgling LTE network for now. And the HTC Evo Design is just one of a few, hopefully better phones, which will be coming, or will at least be announced, later this year.
Will you be able to jump from phone to phone as they get released?
You buy the phone for $100.
Okay, and then they stick a SIM in it and
yeah,
go to
and
town?
Yeah, you're done.
Okay.
As for the plan itself, a few things have changed. Users get 200 free anytime minutes, 500 megabytes of free 3G, 4G data, and 500 free texts, as opposed to unlimited like it originally pitched. Every month, for free, 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 free. And if that doesn't do it for you, you can buy extra data at the price of $2 a megabyte. As you go, you can pick up packs of a gig for $10, 2 gigs for $20, 4 gigs for $35, or 5 gigs for $40. And for voice and text, you can go unlimited for $11 a month. And they're not the only one. Republic Wireless has its Wi-Fi and fantastic phone. Players like Zacht and Ting have super granular billing. But free as service is a serious thing to bring to the table. This kind of shakeup can only work well for consumers. And, of course, you can give us a call at 585. Well, we got so many people on the line, we better just get to them.
All right, let's do it.
And this is Harold. Where are you calling from, Harold?
Hamlin, New York.
Hamlin. How are things in Hamlin?
Wet.
Wet. Yeah. Sounds about right.
What can we do for you?
I just got a new desktop computer, Windows 7, and I went to get the Windows updates, and I say about half of them failed to install. You go to the one window where they show all the new updates and all that, and like half of them failed to install. What do I do?
Well, up to a point, it depends on what they were. Some of them will fail to install because you don't need them. They're updates for things you don't have installed. So, for example, let's say you have an AMD video chipset, and there's an NVIDIA chipset update. You don't need that. It's not going to come to you.
Right.
Usually that isn't called failed, but you have to at least know whether or not it's something you actually need.
Easy thing to try that I would do first is shut the machine down entirely, fire it back up again. You know, do the old turn it off, turn it back on again, and look for more updates and see if those install properly the second time.
The other thing to do is wait a day. One of the problems that Microsoft has is that 100 gazillion machines all try to download the new updates at the same time.
Yep.
And so they fail not because of anything to do with your machine, but because they simply couldn't get a good connection to Microsoft.
All right.
So I would, you know, in general, I don't even bother doing updates for about 2 or 3 days until then. So I, in general, I wouldn't worry about it unless the next time you try it in a few days, you still have a problem.
Right.
And then write down the error messages and then either call someone or let us know on Saturday.
All right, so if I still have the KB number, the update number, could I go out there manually and just download that specific update? Could I try that route too?
Yes, you can. In fact, you can just type that KB number into Google, and one of the things that comes up should be a link right to it.
Right, and you'll want to make sure that the response that you get for that KB search is a site that is ends in Microsoft.com.
Yeah, right.
All right.
So that's what I would do.
Go for it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for giving us a call the way from Hilton.
Hamlin.
Hamlin. Sorry.
Where it's wet.
Yes. Very wet.
Right.
Harold and Hamlin.
Harold and Hamlin. That's how to do it. But yeah, one of the problems that, well, this goes along with everything else we've talked about. 100 gazillion desktops, all of them getting a notice that there's new updates, all of them trying to download the new updates.
Apple had the same problem last week when they tried to do iOS 7. And I've gotten nothing but calls from clients all week saying, should I be doing this? Shouldn't I be doing this? And I tell them all the same thing. If you've got a iPhone 4S, definitely do it. If you've got an iPhone 4, it's still a little pokey, but that's just because the phone is older.
Yeah, right.
And if you've got a 5 or a 5S, definitely jump on it.
Yep. So, I actually turned off my iPad for a day, waited.
Yeah.
Turned it on the next day. Boom. It downloaded
fast,
installed it immediately. No problems.
Yep. So we got another call?
Yes. Gerd from Victor, New York. Hiya, Gerd. What's up?
Hey, guys. You good doing a great job.
Thanks.
By the way, I re-upped my membership, so.
Hey. That's what I like to hear. Thank you.
Very nice.
Here we go. Password managers.
Yes.
Pros and cons, which are better and which are worse, or should they not be used at all?
Use them.
Absolutely use them.
Use them. Don't use the same password for multiple things.
Right.
And the easy way to keep track of all these different passwords is to use a password manager. Let the computer do the heavy lifting for you.
Yeah. I use one called KeePass. There's another great one called LastPass.
On the Mac, we've got one called 1Password that I make use of.
They're all excellent. The basic idea is you can create ridiculously hard passwords.
Or let the computer do it for you.
Or let the computer do it for you, and it will remember all of those things. And all you have to do is remember the 1Password that gets you into the password manager.
Right.
Beautiful.
Love them.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Keep up with the good work.
You too. Thanks, Gerd.
Bye.
Boy, I wish they were all that easy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a pretty black and white question.
Should we
right
do this?
There.
Yes.
Yes.
Long
yes,
answer?
You should.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. People are always complaining I can't remember passwords. First, that's just so much bourgeois because I'm old and slow, and I remember 45 different passwords every single day. So don't tell me you're stupider than I am because you're not. But even if you want to pretend you are, get a password manager. Then you only have to ever remember 1 password. So you can make it a good password.
Right. And if you're going to forget that, tattoo it on your arm.
It's above the sleeve line, so you have to, at least. But it's just 1 password, so use uppercase, lowercase, numbers, symbols in that 1 password you have to remember, and it will tell you all the others.
Yes. Yep. On the Mac, you can actually synchronize that collection of passwords between multiple machines. So if you've got a desktop and a laptop, no problem. If you've got a desktop and an iPhone, no problem. If you've got an iPad to throw into the mix, no problem at all. And there's even a plugin on your laptop and on your desktop for the web browser. So when you get back to that website and you say, oh, man, what was the password for this?
Yep.
No problem. You hit the little button for 1Password, and it goes and finds it and fills it in for you. You don't even have to type in a single letter. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing stuff. And if you're not using a password manager, you're missing out. And, of course, the password managers also, some of them at least, when you set them up, you get to pick the level of encryption. So I always pick 2048.
Yeah, and max it out.
Max it out. And that way, if somebody did want to break into it, they'd need to use the NSA computer. NSA computers can probably do it in an hour.
They'll be dead before they'll figure it out.
Right. But in general, all right. Our next caller, who's this?
We're squeezing them in today.
Zal from Penfield.
Hello.
Zal, hi.
Hey, guys, just in the same topic of that KeePass, et cetera, I guess I'd ask you maybe to throw out your comment thoughts on how secure is the password keeper?
Well, again, yes.
We were just talking about that.
You own to it.
Yep.
Right. And it depends. You can set them up for your own encryption level. So you can say, well, I want this. What happens is when they save the files, they put them, the passwords, they put them in an encrypted file. And on some of them, you can pick that level of encryption. I always pick 2048. So it takes an extra half a second to decrypt that file. I don't care.
Okay. And all these programs have been attacked.
All of them have been attacked.
To prove that they're secure.
Yes. Yes. I'm sure the NSA can get into any of them. But beyond them, no.
Okay.
Yeah, I am a big fan of them. If you're really paranoid, then you use something like KeePass, which can have a separate file that isn't synchronized anywhere,
mm-hmm.
and stick it on a thumb drive.
Yeah, right.
Right, and then you have to put that thumb drive into your computer and bring up the file and type in the password, and then when you put it all away, you pull out that thumb drive, stick it in your pocket. Now somebody has to get physical access to that thumb drive in order to get your passwords.
Right. It's a second level of password protection. It's
right,
not only what you know, but it's something you have.
Right, exactly. And it's essentially two-factor authentication.
And you have to have both of those for it to work.
Yep. And they wipe out their buffers in memory when you close the program. So nothing is saved on the hard drive. Nothing is saved in memory. It's just all on that thumb drive.
So to sum it up, people should look at a password keeper.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make sure they get a good one. as opposed to just whatever they stumble across.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Alan. We're gonna we're done. No, we're not taking a break.
Wow.
We're taking a long break. We're gonna take
a
break of about
weekend.
Of about 6 days and 23 hours.
Yes, that's right.
Is what we're gonna do. But you know what? Don't worry, because coming up next, the best German music you'll hear all week. George is in with the German radio program.
And I continue.
And Michael will stay here to keep him on the straight and narrow as he did to us. I want to thank Dennis Worcester, who was only magnificent. Sorry, it's the best I can say about you.
I will strive
Dennis.
To do better next
and
time.
Then, yeah, try, will you please? I'm Nick Francesco for Dennis Worcester, Michael Oden. We're done for the week. This has been Soundbites on the truly great and truly member-supported, and thank you for that, Jazz 90.1.